The Sanctity of Patents. A singular feature of Gates's vaccine caper, largely unnoticed until recently by the global press, is his ironclad commitment to protect pharma's intellectual property rights. Asked in a Sky News interview if sharing intellectual property and the recipe for vaccines would be helpful, Gates replied bluntly, "No. There's all sorts of issues around intellectual property having to do with medicines, but not in terms of how quickly we've been able to ramp up the volume here. I do a regular phone call with the pharmaceutical CEOs to make sure that work is going at full speed." In April 2021, his unyielding allegiance to patent rights and corporate profits finally caused cracks to appear in the monolithic support for Gates among mainstream media and the public health establishment. That month, the New Republic writer Alexander Zaitchik published a lengthy article, "Vaccine Monster," describing how Bill Gates had aggressively impeded global access to COVID vaccines by the world's poorest people in order to safeguard the profitable patent privileges of his pharmaceutical partners. By March 2020, Indian and African nations anticipating severe vaccine shortages of COVID inoculations for their populations were clamoring for a waiver of patent rights that would allow local manufacturers to rapidly supply hundreds of millions of generic vaccines at prices that would provide access to the poor. Western nations joined the hullabaloo in the cause of patent exemptions, recognizing that government innovation, vast flows of taxpayer subsidies, regulatory waivers, liability exemptions, coercive mandates, and licensing monopolies had given birth to the COVID vaccines, with drug companies themselves playing relatively minor roles. By August 2020, a global movement to waive patents for COVID-19 vaccines had gathered the momentum of a runaway locomotive. Proponents included much of the global research community, major NGOs with long experience in medicines development and access, and dozens of current and former world leaders and public health experts. In a May 2020 open letter, more than 140 political and civil society leaders called upon governments and companies to begin pooling their intellectual property. "Now is not the time to leave this massive and moral task to market forces," they wrote. In early March 2021, the world's leading public health authorities launched a voluntary intellectual property pool inside the WHO to ensure that COVID-19 drugs and vaccines would be universally and cheaply available. The WHO COVID-19 Technology Access Pool, or CTAP. In May 2021, President Biden threw his weight behind the movement, calling for a temporary suspension of patent protections for COVID-19 vaccines to ensure coverage among poorer nations. "We believe that intellectual property rights constitute a very substantial barrier to ensure equitable access," he said. "We believe that if we could have a limited, targeted waiver to ensure that we can ramp up production in various parts of the world, we would go a long way to ensure that we address not only the prevention, but also the treatment of COVID-19. Biden's equity initiative forced Gates into the open. Gates's entire philanthrocapitalism business model rests on the sanctity of knowledge monopolies. And so, with the whole world watching, Gates revealed that patent integrity, the source of vaccine profits to his pharma partners, is the sine qua non of Gates's global health initiatives. When push turns to shove, patent protection eclipses his professed concerns for public health. His ironclad control of WHO made Gates's opposition to CTAP dispositive. The runaway train hit a granite mountain. Any pretense that democracy or equity should determine global health policy collapsed before the raw power and influence of Bill Gates. According to the New Republic, advocates for pooling and open science, who seemed ascendant and even unstoppable that winter, confronted the possibility that they'd been outmatched and outmaneuvered by the most powerful man in global public health. Gates derailed the CTAP pool, replacing it with his own WHO program, the COVID-19 ACT Accelerator, which consecrated industry patent rights and relegated developing world vaccination programs to the charitable impulses of pharmaceutical companies and Western donor nations fighting for their own share of the vaccines. As the predictable result of Gates's intervention, around 130 of the poorest of the world's 190 nations, 2.5 billion people, have had zero access to vaccines as of February 2021. As Zaitchik pointed out, the supply crisis was easily foreseeable. Not only were the obstacles posed by intellectual property easily predictable a year ago, there was no lack of people making noise about the urgency of avoiding them. Gates had once again used his international reputation and money authority to shield corporate greed with a halo effect. International health officials warned, for example, that despite all government expressions of concern about Africa, less than 2% of all doses administered globally have been in Africa. Just 1.5% of the continent's population are fully vaccinated. Paradoxically, these nations happen to have lower COVID mortalities by orders of magnitude. There has never been a point at which the Gates Foundation, before the pandemic, at the start of the pandemic, and now at the worst moment of the pandemic, is willing to surrender and look at IP as something that has to be managed differently to ensure that we're doing as much as possible, said Rohit Malpani, board member of the global health agency UNITAID. Gates opposed waiving some provisions of the World Trade Organization's agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, or TRIPS. A waiver would allow member nations to stop enforcing a set of COVID-19-related patents for the duration of the pandemic. Bill Gates asked everyone to block the TRIPS waiver and trust a handful of companies hoarding IP and know-how, said James Love, director at Knowledge Ecology International. Gates's commitment to patent rights is existential and unyielding. Gates has ruthlessly defended intellectual property monopolies since his early battles with open-source hobbyists in Microsoft's natal days. Gates built both his fortune and his charitable model of philanthrocapitalism on the sanctity of intellectual property protections in software, food, and drugs. Gates made his bones with his big pharma partners by triumphing over Nelson Mandela in hand-to-hand combat during the grim African AIDS crisis of the 1990s. South Africa was ground zero in the global AIDS epidemic, with HIV infection rates affecting one in every five adults. Mandela had made himself the paladin in a Third World Crusade to allow generic drug makers to give the global poor access to expensive AIDS drugs. Mandela's reputation as a kind of saint stymied the pharmaceutical companies, reluctant to defend a venal business model that, by their own estimation, was a death sentence for 29 million African children and adults. Cloaking himself in the moral authority as the world's largest charitable benefactor, Gates stepped forward as the industry champion, expounding the cause of intellectual property and knowledge monopolies over public health. That ghillie suit of selfless altruism successfully confused the press and public, especially the liberal establishment, about Gates's solipsistic motives for over two decades. In December 1997, Mandela's administration pushed through a law allowing the health officials to import, produce, or purchase generic AIDS drugs that were out of reach for most Africans. Pharma was happy to test AIDS drugs on Africans, but had priced the final product far out of their reach. Glaxo, for example, was still selling annual dosages of AZT for $10,000, Gates declared war on Mandela and his generic drug crusade by supporting a suit by 39 pharma multinationals who sued South Africa to prevent poorer nations from accessing generic AIDS drugs for their people. Once again, Gates put the halo on greed. The New Republic chronicled the fight. In Geneva, the lawsuit was reflected in a battle at the WHO, which was divided along a north-south fault line. On one side, the home countries of the Western drug companies. On the other, a coalition of most from the global south and dozens of leading public health groups, including Médecins Sans Frontières and Oxfam, joined the battle on behalf of Mandela. In the end, Gates and Pharma won the legal case, and Gates helped push through enduring bulletproof protection for pharmaceutical patents by his implacable support of the trade-related aspects of intellectual property, TRIPS, an international agreement that outlawed the use of unsanctioned generics to combat AIDS and other diseases. Today, leading public health officials agree that the primary drivers of the current artificial shortage of COVID-19 vaccines is Gates's defense of intellectual property rights to protect the profiteering by his pharma partners. Zaitchik recounts how battle-scarred public health veterans saw clearly, for the first time, how Gates's addiction to proprietary science and market monopolies easily overrode his professed concern about the impacts of the pandemic and poor nations and the structural inequality in access to medicines. COVID-19 reveals the deep structural inequality in access to medicines globally, and a root cause is IP that sustains and dominates industries' interests at the cost of lives. Zaitchik offers a devastating indictment of Gates. Gates is certain he knows better, but his failure to anticipate a crisis of supply and his refusal to engage those who predicted it have complicated the carefully maintained image of an all-knowing, saintly, mega-philanthropist. COVAX presents a high-stakes demonstration of Gates's deepest ideological commitments, not just to intellectual property rights, but also to the conflation of these rights with an imaginary free market in pharmaceuticals, an industry dominated by companies whose power derives from politically constructed and politically imposed monopolies. After describing how Gates pushed back ruthlessly defending the status quo and running effective interference for those profiting by the billions from their control of COVID-19 vaccines, Zaitchik offers a glimmer of hope for humanity's most downtrodden third fighting for their lives against this vaccine monster. There are signs of overdue scrutiny of Gates's role in public health and lifelong commitment to exclusive intellectual property rights. Blacks to the front of the line. At the February 2021 press conference, Francis Collins said that NIH's new generation of HIV vaccines will specifically target Africans and African Americans to make sure everybody, everywhere, has the opportunity to be cured, not just those in high-income countries. Such sympathies were a consistent preoccupation along the Gates NIH nexus. Melinda Gates lamented on CNN April 10, 2020, that she was kept up at night worrying about vulnerable populations in Africa. In June 2020, she told Time magazine that in the United States, black people should get the COVID-19 vaccine first. The idea that blacks should be first in line for the vaccine, and official anxieties that many blacks would resist this privilege, were persistent themes in pronouncements by the leading health agencies during the pandemic. As we shall see in Chapter 12, Gates, Fauci, and the intelligence agency and pharmaceutical company partners repeatedly war-gamed strategies for overcoming anticipated black resistance in many of the dozen pandemic simulations leading up to COVID-19. Once the pandemic was underway, HHS recruited black preachers, HBCU college deans, civil rights leaders, and sports figures like Hank Aaron to soften jab hesitancy in the black community. They staged press conferences and highly publicized celebrity vaccination confabs and extravagantly financed government advertising campaigns targeting blacks in both the United States and Africa. In December 2020, Dr. Fauci scolded resistance in the black community, saying, "The time is now to put skepticism aside." Without citing any studies demonstrating the vaccine was safe, he said that the first thing that you might want to say to my African brothers and sisters is that the vaccine you're going to be taking was developed by an African-American woman, and that's just a fact. When Cicely Tyson, Marvin Hagler, and rapper Earl Simmons, a.k.a. DMX, all died soon after taking COVID vaccines, the medical community and CDC rushed in to assure the African-American community that the deaths were not vaccine-related. Social media and mainstream outlets censored or removed stories that suggested a vaccine association. Gates-funded fact-checker organizations debunked any link. The desperation to discredit such talk inspired many respectable media outfits to simply lie. When home run king Hank Aaron, whom I knew, died 17 days after receiving a vaccine at a staged press conference at Atlanta's Morehouse College, I wrote that his death was among a wave of deaths in older people following vaccination. I never said the vaccine caused Aaron's death. The New York Times, CNN, ABC, NBC, Inside Edition, and 100 news organizations across the globe rushed to castigate me and rebuff my article as vaccine misinformation, assuring the public that the Fulton County coroner had declared Aaron's death unrelated to the vaccine. When I called the Fulton County coroner, the office informed me that they had never seen Hank Aaron's body, and that Aaron's family had buried him without autopsy. After I published this embarrassing fact, not a single news organization posted a retraction. Federal law requires that every injury or death following vaccination during clinical trials, or by logical extension with emergency use products, must be attributed to the vaccine unless proven otherwise. Nevertheless, as of August 2021, the CDC officially took the Pollyanna-ish view that not one of the 13,000-plus deaths reported to VAERS following vaccination as of August 20, 2021, was vaccine-related. Not one. As was the case with Hank Aaron, CDC apparently did nothing to actively investigate any of those deaths, exonerating the vaccines instead by fiat. While unusual numbers of black celebrities were dying post-vaccination in America, an eyebrow-raising number of anti-vax political leaders were simultaneously expiring in Africa. The epidemic of untimely deaths among high-profile black African heads of state and key government ministers and physicians who opposed Bill Gates' COVAX policies provoked a wave of conspiracy theories suggesting that these men were murdered to silence dissent. The phenomenon was so striking during the first year of the pandemic that both Reuters and the British medical journal BMJ published articles seeking to explain the troubling trend. The internet assassination speculations reached a boil following the strange murder of President Jovenel Moise of Haiti by a team of elite, well-trained Colombian mercenaries with links to United States intelligence agencies. Moise was a vocal opponent of the WHO vaccine program. The African leaders who died suddenly after criticizing WHO vaccination policy included President John Magufuli of Tanzania, March 17, 2021, Prime Minister Hamed Bakayoko of Ivory Coast, March 10, 2021, President Pierre Nkurunziza of Burundi, January 8, 2020, and Madagascar's popular, influential, and anti-vax ex-president Didier Ignace Ratsiraka, March 28, 2021. Kenya's beloved physician Stephen Karanja, the chairman of the Kenya Catholic Doctors Association, who had exposed the WHO sterilization program in 2014 and who criticized the agency's COVID rollout in 2020, also died, reportedly of COVID, April 29, 2021. A peer-reviewed article in the BMJ titled, "Why Have So Many African Leaders Died of COVID?" lists 17 heads of state and leading government health ministers who passed in the 12 months between February of 2020 and February of 2021. The BMJ article states that almost all of these deaths resulted in dramatic shifts in national health policies from skepticism toward strong support for vaccination in their respective countries. The article points out that the overall death rates, 1 in 33, among African elected leaders from COVID are 7 times the rates for their sex and age and demographics of the general population during that time period. I do not endorse the theory that these men were murdered, nor do I dismiss such speculation out of hand. It is naive to believe that powerful men and women who threaten a trillion-dollar industry allied with Western military and intelligence agencies do so without risk. I document the keen interest by the Western intelligence community and militaries in the African vaccine enterprise in Chapter 12, Germ Games. The historic involvement of Western intelligence agencies in coups and the murders of African leaders on behalf of their corporate clientele is well documented. I have a clear personal memory of the shocked reaction by my father and my uncle John Kennedy to the assassination of Congo's liberator Patrice Lumumba on my birthday, January 17, 1961, a week before my uncle John Kennedy's inauguration as U.S. president. JFK regarded Lumumba as the George Washington of the Congo. U.S. and European mining companies had their eyes on the Congo's vast mineral wealth, and Lumumba, a beloved nationalist who led the Congo's liberation movement against Belgium, had sworn to deploy that wealth instead to benefit the Congolese people. We have since learned that the CIA and the Belgian intelligence agencies collaborated in Lumumba's murder. In 2002, Belgium formally apologized for its role in the assassination. CIA Director Alan Dulles, who planned to kill Lumumba with poison toothpaste, knew that my uncle had enormous affection and admiration for Lumumba. Dulles feared that JFK would interfere with the CIA's plan to liquidate the charismatic leader. Among other mischief, the CIA overthrew governments in Ghana in 1966 and Chad in 1982. Congressional investigations in the 1970s exposed the CIA's years of experimentation to develop untraceable poisons and secretive murder tools. CIA scientists, including NIH brain surgeon Maitland Baldwin, working under MKUltra's director Sidney Gottlieb at Fort Detrick, concocted a diabolical arsenal of assassination weaponry, including beamed radio frequency radiation, pathogenic microbes, and dissipating chemicals, all intended to mimic natural deaths. This armory of toxins gave the agency capacity to assassinate uncooperative foreign leaders while avoiding suspicion. Such shenanigans suggest that it is our duty as citizens to remain alert to the times democracy might lose control of rogue intelligence agencies. Dr. Gates, I presume. Media recipients of pharma advertising dollars and Gates Foundation lucre like to characterize Gates as a public health expert. But 6 years after Gates summoned Dr. Fauci to his Seattle mansion, two Los Angeles Times investigative reporters, Charles Piller and Doug Smith, employed the term white man's burden to describe the catastrophic impact of Gates's medical meddling in Africa. That title suggests that Gates' efforts to rescue the dark races from disease and famine, mask all the familiar impulses for imperial control. The comprehensive study provides eloquent testimony to the lethal effect of Gates's natal arrogance on children. Pillar and Smith detail how Gates's systematic diversion of Africa's international medical spending to his high-tech, high-price, and often untested vaccines is killing babies across Africa. Gates's prioritization of vaccines has dried the stream of foreign assistance that once flowed to basic nutrition and that financed the cheap, functional medical devices that could prevent many deaths. The team at the Los Angeles Times documents how in a single Lesotho hospital, one or two babies die from asphyxiation every day for lack of a $35 oxygen valve. That life-saving valve is outside the purview of Gates's $400 million annual vaccine giving, almost all of which goes to HIV, polio, TB, and malaria vaccines. Gates's regimen has also deprioritized the off-patent malaria medicines like hydroxychloroquine that could prevent half of all malaria deaths at 12 cents per dose, as well as $4 mosquito nets that can spare a child from contracting malaria. It estimates that $3 of food and conventional medicines to each new mother could prevent 5 million child deaths annually. The Times investigation found that Gates's programs, including those of the Global Fund and the Gavi Alliance, have had net negative consequences on public health. In fact, the Times found an inverse correlation between dollars spent by Gates's charities and declines in children's health. The nations that get the most Gates money see the worst health outcomes. By narrowing the focus of international relief aid to fund pharma solutions to a handful of celebrity diseases, Gates has not only reduced public expenditures on basic equipment and life-saving food and water, he has pulled many of the best healthcare workers and researchers away from life-saving basic care. The LA Times quotes leaders in half a dozen sub-Saharan African nations facing desperate shortages while doctors and nurses chase extravagant salaries that Gates's Global Fund pays to clinicians who provide antiretroviral drug therapy, known as ART, for HIV/AIDS patients. The resulting staff shortages have abandoned many children of AIDS survivors to more common killers, birth sepsis, diarrhea, and asphyxia. In Rwanda, the Los Angeles Times reports, nurses earning $50 to $100 a month in local clinics work beside Gates-supported nurses earning $175 to $200 a month. All over the country, people are furious about incentives for ART staff, said Rachel M. Cohen, who is Doctors Without Borders' Lesotho mission chief. Her organization staffs the government health clinics. The Los Angeles Times concludes that Gates's obsession with vaccine-preventable diseases has proportionally reduced assistance streams for nutrition, transportation, hygiene, and economic development, causing negative overall impacts on public health. Many AIDS patients have so little food that they vomit their free AIDS pills. For lack of bus fare, others cannot get to clinics that offer life-saving treatment. The Gates Foundation addresses these catastrophic impacts on broader health concerns by blocking Africans from talking about any problem that is not susceptible to a vaccine solution. According to the report, Gates-funded vaccination programs have instructed caregivers to ignore, even discourage patients from discussing, ailments that the vaccinations cannot prevent. This is especially harmful in outposts where a visit to a clinic for a shot is the only contact some villagers have with healthcare providers for years. WHO, Gavi, and the Global Fund effectively function as ideological commissars enforcing Gates's vanity priorities. The Times reporter found that their oversight has caused key measures of societal health to have stalled at appalling levels or worsened. Gates's claim that his vaccines have saved several million lives is a reflexive trope for which he offers no proof, no validation, and no accountability. Most of the preeminent decision-makers and advisors in the Gates organization are former pharmaceutical industry moguls and regulators who not surprisingly share his pharma-centric worldview. For example, Dr. Tadataka Yamada, an unsavory bully who served as president of the Gates Foundation's global health program from 2005 to 2011, was the former research director for GlaxoSmithKline. He left GSK just a few steps ahead of a U.S. Senate Finance Committee seeking to question him about multiple accusations that he conducted an intimidation campaign to threaten and silence prominent doctors exploring the British drug maker for knowingly killing some 83,000 Americans with its blockbuster diabetes drug, Avandia. Gates knew of Yamada's sordid conduct because the Senate committee staffers sent his foundation a letter requesting Yamada submit to questioning. A 2007 article by one of these staffers, Alicia Mundy, describes how Yamada repeatedly lied to his interrogators. Yamada's successor at BMGF, Trevor Mundell, was an executive at both Novartis and Pfizer. The foundation's chief communications officer, Kate James, worked at GSK for almost 10 years. Penny Heaton worked for Merck and Novartis before Gates named her as director of vaccine development at BMGF. So it's not surprising that Gates's success metrics rarely measure better health outcomes, but only the number of vaccines administered and the number of pills distributed and consumed. Many believe that the Global Fund's tight remit is increasingly becoming a straitjacket, complains a 2007 editorial on the Global Fund in The Lancet Infectious Diseases. The failure to support basic care as comprehensively as vaccines and research is a blind spot for the Gates Foundation, said Paul Farmer, recipient of a John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Fellowship and founder of Partners in Health, which has received Gates Foundation funding for research and training. It doesn't surprise me that as someone who has made his fortune on developing a novel technology, Bill Gates would look for magic bullets in vaccines and medicines, Farmer said. But if we don't have a solid delivery system, this work will be thwarted. He added, that's something that's going to be hard for the big foundations. They treat tuberculosis. They don't treat poverty. African public health leaders protest that Gates refuses to finance traditional medical supplies that spell life or death in African clinics. Lesotho's health minister, Empura Matlapeng, now executive vice president of the Clinton Foundation, told The Times that a $7 million annual donation would allow her to raise the pay of every government health professional by two-thirds, sufficient to retain most of them. But this sort of banal need bores Mr. Gates. His global fund has poured $59 million into Lesotho to advance his priorities, which are the high-profit vaccines and drugs that enrich his pharma partners. Dr. Fauci and Gates's obsession with AIDS is great for companies like Merck and Glaxo, with which the two men partner, but it's been a lousy deal for Africans. Like Dr. Fauci, Gates raises expectations yet takes no responsibility and offers no convincing proof that his schemes have had a beneficial impact on morbidities, public health, or quality of life. There are meager signs of tangible benefits to the poor. Instead, every effort to measure the health outcomes of Gates's interventions has exposed them as cataclysmic for their beneficiaries. In 2017, the Danish government commissioned a study of health outcomes among African children who received WHO's flagship DTP vaccine, the world's most popular inoculation. They found that vaccinated girls had 10 times the death rate compared to unvaccinated girls. The investigation by the Los Angeles Times found that Botswana, a favored target of Gates's and his corporate amigos' largesse, has seen few tangible benefits from the attention. Botswana is a stable, well-governed democracy with a relatively high living standard and a small population, but one of the world's highest HIV infection rates. In 2000, the Gates Foundation partnered with Merck to launch a $100 million pilot program in Botswana to showcase how mass AIDS treatment with vaccines, patented antivirals, and prevention could eliminate AIDS in Africa. The pilot's disastrous failure instead became a parable for how Gates' obsession with expensive pharmaceuticals is killing Africans. The project produced no reduction in HIV rates. By 2005, the virus had spread to a quarter of all adults. All those deadly retrovirals and vaccines from Tony Fauci's Little Shop of Horrors exacted a fearsome toll on Botswana's mothers and infants. The rate of pregnancy-related maternal deaths nearly quadrupled, and child mortality rose dramatically. Health economist Dean Jameson, formerly editor of the Gates Foundation-funded reference book, Disease Control Priorities in Developing Countries, acknowledged that the Gates Foundation's narrow obsession with AIDS drugs may have accelerated death and illness in Botswana by drawing the nation's top medical professionals away from primary care and child health. They have an opportunity to double or triple their salaries by working on AIDS, Jameson said. Maybe the health ministry replaces them when they leave government service. Maybe not. The Gates Foundation has poured billions into sub-Saharan Africa through the Global Fund to finance vaccines and antivirals for AIDS and TB treatment for 3.9 million people. But one AIDS patient, Moleko, told the Times, "The clinics don't have what we need. Food." Majubali Mathibalai, the nurse at Queen II Hospital who gives Moleko her pills, wept in frustration as she told the Times reporter that 4 out of 5 of her patients ate fewer than 3 meals a day. Most of them, she said, are dying of hunger. In Lesotho and Rwanda, dozens of patients described hunger so brutal that nausea prevented them from keeping their anti-AIDS pills down. Nathibalai said that Gates' Global Fund was out of touch. "They have their computers in nice offices and are comfortable," she said, nervous about speaking bluntly, "but they are not coming down to our level. We've got to tell the truth so something will be done." Dr. Jennifer Furin, the Lesotho Director for Partners in Health, a Boston-based NGO, made a similar complaint. "By giving African patients medicine without food," she said, "you're consigning that person to death because they are poor." Antipathy toward locally controlled healthcare systems. Dr. Francis Omaswa, special advisor for human resources at the WHO, estimates that Gates's spending could be 5 times more beneficial if he directed his philanthropy toward addressing poverty and supporting existing health systems. This is the most common critique among knowledgeable public health experts. According to Global Justice Now, the BMGF's heavy focus on developing new vaccines detracts from other more vital health priorities, such as building resilient health systems. Unfortunately, the idea of building local institutions to support democracy and public interest is inconsistent with Gates's technology-based approach to public health. As Dr. David Legge explained to The Gray Zone, Gates has got a mechanistic view of global health in terms of looking for silver bullets. All of the things he supports are largely framed as silver bullets. That means that major issues that have been identified in the World Health Assembly are not being addressed, including, in particular, the social determinants of health and the development of health systems. University of Toronto public health professor Anne Emmanuelle Byrne wrote in 2005 that the Gates Foundation had a narrowly conceived understanding of health as the product of technical interventions divorced from economic, social, and political contexts. The Gates Foundation has long championed private sector involvement in and private sector profit-making from global health, Byrne told The Gray Zone. One of Gavi's senior representatives even reported that Bill Gates often told him in private conversations that he is vehemently against health systems because it is a complete waste of money. Katarini Storeng, researcher at Oslo's Center for Development and Environment, writes that a Gavi staffer told her that the foundation was a very loud vocal voice, saying that we do not believe in the strengthening of health systems. A former Gavi employee and HSS health systems strengthening proponent recounted how he and his colleagues used to roll down the HSS posters when Bill Gates came to visit the Gavi headquarters in Geneva because he is known to hate this part of Gavi's work. Gates's antipathy toward public health systems reflects a pathological, almost bigoted contempt for African institutions and science, Storing's report also notes. Gates's patterns of funding reflect his bias toward white Western institutions and his hostility toward indigenous community-based African solutions. Lindsay McGoey argues that a commitment to true equity should entail offering money directly to capable health teams based in the global South, better resourcing of their universities, their access to scientific research, and their ability to publish more extensively leading journals. Gates seems impervious to the importance of cultivating local leadership, institutions, and talent. His giving patterns reinforce the colonial architecture that keeps the authority to call the shots outside Africa. Investigating the Gates Foundation's global health spending in 2009, British public health policy expert David McCoy found that of 659 grants BMGF awarded to non-governmental or for-profit organizations, 560 went to organizations in high-income countries, mainly in the U.S. Only 37 grants went to NGOs based in low- or middle-income countries. Similarly, of the 231 grants BMGF awarded to universities, only 12 went to universities based in developing regions. Lindsay McGoey points out that the very limited direct funding in these countries automatically excludes scientists and program managers who best understand the problems from contributing creative solutions. In his book, The White Man's Burden, economist William Easterly, who co-directs the Development Research Institute at New York University, asks, "Who chose the human right of universal treatment of AIDS over other human rights?" The answer to that question, of course, is Bill Gates. Bill Gates's continent-wide experiment on the African population is a long, tragic joke. The Times reporters deliver its devastating punchline. 2006 data, the most recent available, show a paradoxical relationship between Gavi funding in Africa and child mortality. Overall, child mortality improved more often in nations that received smaller-than-average Gavi grants per capita. In seven nations that received greater-than-average funding, child mortality rates worsened. Neutralizing the press. Pillar and Smith's Los Angeles Times expose on Gates's calamitous African adventure is an artifact of an expired era. Investigative journalism of this probative quality is a quaint relic of a time when editors and producers still permitted their reporters and correspondents to express skepticism toward Gates. Even before the open censorship of the COVID epoch, U.S. media reports about Gates's charities operated in the narrow range between obsequious fawning and adulation. This is no accident. By 2006, the tsunami of advertising revenues from pharmaceutical firms, about $4.8 billion annually, had already drowned out most of the voices of vaccine dissent in mainstream media. By 2020, those expenditures grew to $9.53 billion. After the devastating Los Angeles Times piece, Gates moved aggressively to neutralize the once independent press with compromising grants that struggling news organizations couldn't refuse. An August 2020 expose by Tim Schwab in the Columbia Journalism Review showed how Gates dispensed at least $250 million in grants to media outlets including NPR, Public Television, PBS, The Guardian, The Independent, BBC, Al Jazeera, ProPublica, The Daily Telegraph, The Atlantic, The Texas Tribune, Gannett, Washington Monthly, Le Monde, The Financial Times, The National Journal, Univision, Medium, and The New York Times to dampen journalistic appetites for, well, journalism. In fact, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation finances The Guardian's entire global development section. That shrewd investment presumably earned the couple this February 14, 2017 Guardian headline, "How Bill and Melinda Gates Helped Save 122 Million Lives and What They Want to Solve Next." The Guardian calls Gates and his partner, Warren Buffett, Superman and Batman. The foundation has also invested millions in journalism training and in researching effective ways of crafting media narratives to support Gates's global ambitions. Gates, for example, gave grants totaling nearly $1.5 million from 2015 through 2019 to the Center for Investigative Reporting, apparently to discourage investigative reporting. According to the Seattle Times, experts coached in Gates-funded programs write columns that appear in media outlets from the New York Times to the Huffington Post, while digital portals blur the line between journalism and spin. The Gates Foundation frequently hosts strategic media partners meetings at its headquarters in Seattle. Representatives from the New York Times, The Guardian, NBC, NPR, and the Seattle Times all attended a 2013 convocation. The aim of the event, wrote Tom Paulson, a Seattle-based reporter, was to improve the narrative of media coverage of global aid and development, highlighting good news stories rather than tales of waste or corruption. That same year, the BMGF gave marketing colossus Ogilvy & Mather, a global public relations firm, a $100,000 grant for a project titled "Aid is Working, Tell the World." Subsequent articles in The Nation reported that Gates had invested in a retinue of companies positioned to mint windfall profits from the COVID crisis and documented the reluctance of players in the philanthropic donor community and key charities to criticize their self-serving arrangements. Fearful of his prowess and reputation for vendetta, leading charities keep their mouths shut about Gates' recipe for leavening his altruism with profiteering. They call this omerta the Bill Chill. Gates has also made large strategic investments in Pointer and the International Network of Fact-Checking Organizations, which dutifully debunks virtually every public statement that seems critical of Gates, whether accurate or not. In 2008, the communications chief for PBS NewsHour, Rob Flynn, explained that there are not a heck of a lot of things you could touch in global health these days that would not have some kind of Gates tentacle. This was around the time when the foundation gave NewsHour $3.5 million to establish a dedicated production unit to report on important global health issues. That kind of moolah purchased a lot of goodwill from the Fourth Estate. Jeff Bezos's Washington Post called Gates the champion of science-backed solutions. The New York Times gushes that he is the most interesting man in the world. Time magazine dubbed him Master of the Universe. Forbes calls Gates savior of the world, who set the standard for a billionaire good citizen. Looking on admiringly, editors of fashion magazine Vogue wondered, Why isn't Bill Gates running the coronavirus task force? Ignoring the fact that Gates never graduated from college, much less medical school, mainstream media outlets unanimously parrot BBC's assessment that Gates is a public health expert and ridicule those who question whether the whole world should take his self-serving advice on lockdowns, masks, and vaccines. In just the month of April 2020, while the virus and lockdowns were severely impacting the United States, Gates and Fauci did tag-team appearances on CNN, CNBC, Fox, PBS, BBC, CBS, MSNBC, The Daily Show, and The Ellen DeGeneres Show, reinforcing their self-serving messages about lockdowns and vaccines. None of those reporters mentioned the fact that the quarantines that Gates was cheerleading on their networks have increased Gates's wealth by $22 billion over 12 months. And Gates's efforts to promote his contrary narrative claims only exacerbate their limitations. Gates's emphasis on conditional lending, corporate partnerships, top-down control, high-tech cookie-cutter solutions, and patent privileges tends to favor wealthy nations and multinational corporations. These are just a few of the ways in which current development policies are failing the Global South. If aid flows are working well, asks McGoey, why do they need a masterful PR campaign to convey that message effectively? Many observers on the left and right suggest that the problem isn't a marketing failure, it's a failure with the underlying product. Aid, they argue, is not working. Please go to the Children's Health Defense website for the acknowledgments, endnotes by chapter, updates to data, and new information that becomes available on any of the subject matter covered in this audiobook.